Cultures, Rysak continued, that do not see the world as a stage, do not see people as persons, that is, as actors in a play. That is why they lack the concept of tragedy, because the essence of tragedy is that it has a prescripted ending. Tragedy belongs to a world in which there is such a thing as inexorable fate, what the Greeks called Moira or Ananke. That is a mindset wholly alien to the Hebrew Bible. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 73, Hamlet and the Herodians. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Shakespeare's Hamlet is perhaps the most famous play ever written, and many are familiar with the plot. Prince Hamlet of Denmark is visited by the ghost of his dead father, the late king, who reveals that he, the king, has been murdered by his brother Claudius, who not only became king in his stead, but also married the murdered king's widow, Hamlet's mother, Gertrude. This revelation sets Hamlet on a path that destroys his relationships and ends with the death of most of the main characters in the play. What is often missed, however, is that Hamlet is already in deep depression at the very beginning of Shakespeare's work, before he meets his father's ghost, before he learns of the regicide of the king, because Hamlet is, at the very outset, upset by the fact that his mother, widowed only a month, has married her brother-in-law, a relationship that Hamlet calls incest. Hamlet says in the play, quote, "Married with mine uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, ere yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married, oh, most wicked speed, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot, come to good." End quote. As the scholar Jason Rosenblatt has written, this can only be fully understood if one bears biblical marriage laws in mind. Leviticus states that one is forbidden from marrying one's brother's widow, but Deuteronomy emphasizes an exception known as levirate marriage. If one's brother has died and left no children, then one was allowed to marry the widow and, through the children produced by that marriage, ensure familial continuity. But again, that is only true if the dead brother had no children. If one's dead brother produced children, then marrying his widow is forbidden. The English population in the age of Shakespeare would have been well aware of this biblical doctrine, for those texts in Leviticus and Deuteronomy were at the center of the controversy surrounding Henry VIII's marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Catherine had been married originally to Henry's brother, who had died without an heir. As Rosenblatt further argues, understanding this reveals deeper themes within Shakespeare's play. For Claudius and Gertrude to marry would only have been permitted if Hamlet had never been born, if no children had been produced by Gertrude's original marriage. Thus, in remarrying, Hamlet's mother is acting as if she is nullifying Hamlet's own existence. Thus, at the beginning of the play, when the new king, Claudius, notes Hamlet's depression and asks him, "How is it that the clouds still hang on you?" Hamlet replies, "Not so, my lord. I am too much in the sun." This is a pun, for Shakespeare was the greatest punster in English, with the possible exception of whoever writes headlines for the New York Post. Hamlet here is ostensibly speaking of the sun, S-U-N, but is also saying, "I am too much in the sun," S-O-N. He is emphasizing that he is a son of the deceased king, that king had had a son, and that is why the marriage of the queen to her brother-in-law is actually forbidden. Similarly, when the ghost of the deceased king first appears, he emphasizes to Hamlet not only the crime of regicide, but also the fact that his wife married his brother, saying, "Oh, horrible, oh, horrible, most horrible. If thou hast nature in thee, bear it not. Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest." End quote. This is Hamlet, but it is not only Hamlet, because in a strange and striking way, this plot is partially paralleled in a story reported by Josephus, a tale that, according to his Antiquities, unfolded in the first years of the post-Herodian era in Jerusalem. We have seen how Herod's death was preceded 5 days earlier by the execution of his eldest son, Antipater. With Herod's passing and much lobbying by his children with Augustus, the kingdom of Herod was divided up amongst some of his other children, with one, Archelaus, being granted the title of ethnarch, or governor of the region of Judea. This Archelaus, in turn, proceeded to do something that shocked the populace, and that is relevant to the plot of Hamlet. He married the widow of his dead half-brother, Alexander. Since his brother Alexander had had children, therefore this relationship with Alexander's widow would have been considered absolutely forbidden to Archelaus. Thus, Josephus writes about Archelaus, quote, Moreover, he transgressed the law of our fathers and married Glaphyra, adding who had been the wife of his brother Alexander, which Alexander had 3 children by her, while it was a thing detestable among the Jews to marry the brother's wife. End quote. Thus did Archelaus commit the same sin as Claudius, and we should understand what it says about him. Leoncas, in his book on Genesis, describing the biblical notion of marrying one's brother's widow if that deceased brother produced no children, reflects that while many today might find this concept strange, for him, for Cass, it reveals the Bible's approach to the core of marriage, or as he puts it, quote, if we are willing to set aside for the moment our current sensibilities, we may be able to discover and even appreciate the principles that inform this ancient custom. For details aside, the practice of levirate marriage seeks to uphold what is centrally important in marriage altogether. The heart of marriage, especially but not only biblically speaking, is not primarily a matter of the heart. Rather, it is primarily about procreation and even more about transmission of a way of life. Husband and wife, whether they know it or not, are incipiently father and mother, parents of children for whose moral and spiritual education they bear a sacred obligation. In levirate marriage, all these crucial principles are defended. A man serves literally as his brother's keeper. He refuses to allow his brother to die without a trace. Also, he refuses to nullify his sister-in-law's marriage, vindicating her claim to motherly fulfillment within her marriage, taking seriously the commandment, be fruitful and multiply. Levirate marriage elevates the importance of progeny above personal gratification, and hence the importance of lineage and community above the individual. End quote. So Cass writes, the point is not that marriage is not linked to love. It is, of course, ideally linked to love. But rather that for Judaism, continuity is central and elevated in biblical marriage above the value of personal gratification. But personal gratification, individual desire, was exactly what motivated the Herodians, including Herod's son Archelaus. Archelaus' governing over Jerusalem lasted 10 years, until around the year 6, and then he was summoned to Rome because news of his tyrannical ways had reached the emperor, or as Josephus puts it, quote, in the 10th year of Archelaus' government, both his brethren and the principal men of Judea and Samaria, not being able to bear his barbarous and tyrannical usage of them, accused him before Caesar, and that especially because they knew had broken the command of Caesar, which obliged him to behave with moderation among them. End quote. Augustus summarily banished Archelaus to the faraway region of Gaul. Now here, ladies and gentlemen, is where the story gets a bit more eerie. Josephus reports that both Archelaus and the sister-in-law that he had taken as a wife had dreams at around this point. This is Josephus' account of Archelaus' dream, one which he writes occurred right before Archelaus was summoned to Rome. Quote, now before Archelaus was gone up to Rome upon this message, he related this dream to his friends, that he saw ears of corn in number 10, full of wheat, perfectly ripe, which ears, as it seemed to him, were devoured by oxen. End quote. This dream, Josephus continues, was accordingly interpreted by someone to mean that after 10 years of rulership, he was now about to lose his power. Of course, when we read this, we think immediately of a different dream, and that is the famous story of Pharaoh in the saga of Joseph. Pharaoh, whose dream of 7 cows that devour portends the disaster of 7 years of famine yet to come. Here, the devouring of 10 ears of corn predicts the end of 10 years of Archelaus' rule. Perhaps the dream of Archelaus, building on the Joseph story, may have psychologically reflected how Archelaus himself sensed that he was in trouble with the emperor, how after 10 years his grip on power was endangered. Then there is Josephus' account of the dream of Archelaus' sister-in-law, whom he had taken as a wife. She, we are told by Josephus, had a vision of her deceased first husband. Quote, she thought she saw Alexander standing by her, at which she rejoiced and embraced him with great affection, but that he complained to her. And Josephus adds that he said in part, didst not thou pledge thy faith to me, and wast not thou married to me when thou wast a virgin, and had we not children between us? And Josephus adds that Alexander said, in an indecent and imprudent manner hast entered into my house, and hast been married to Archelaus, thy husband and my brother. However, I will not forget thy former kind affection for me, but will set thee free from every such reproachful action, and cause thee to be mine again, as thou once wast. And Josephus concludes, when she had related this to her female companions, in a few days' time she departed this life. End quote. That is the story Josephus gives us. Reading it, I was struck by the similarity to the plot of Hamlet. Violations of biblical marriage laws, visions of deceased husbands, and of course, tragic ends. And while Shakespeare was certainly drawing on earlier versions of the Hamlet story in producing his play, I could not help but wonder whether he had read this story from Josephus somewhere. We cannot know for sure. But one thing is certain, which is that whereas Hamlet is part of a literary genre known as tragedy, the story of Jerusalem that we are telling over this year is not such a story. And indeed, as Rabbi Sacks noted many times, there is no Hebrew word for the genre tragedy. Rabbi Sacks noted another linguistic curiosity in the same vein. Quote, "What I discovered when my books were being translated into Hebrew is that this ancient language, 4,000 years old, has no word for person, and this created enormous difficulties for my translators. Hebrew ha'ish, which means a man, adam, which roughly means homo sapiens, enosh, which means a mortal, and ben adam, which means son of man, but no word that corresponds to person." Rabbi Sacks added that the answer lies in the history of the word person itself. It comes from the Latin persona, which means a mask, specifically a mask worn by a character on a stage. In other words, it refers to a role played within a theatrical drama. It's a metaphor that belongs to cultures that can say with Shakespeare, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players," or more powerfully in Macbeth, "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more." Cultures, Rabbi Sacks continued, that do not see the world as a stage, do not see people as persons, that is, as actors in a play. That is why they lack the concept of tragedy, because the essence of tragedy is that it has a prescripted ending. You know from the beginning that it's all going to end in tears. Tragedy belongs to a world in which there is such a thing as inexorable fate, what the Greeks called moira or ananke. That is a mindset wholly alien to the Hebrew Bible. End quote. Judaism, as Rabbi Sacks reflected, embodies the rejection of the pagan concept of tragedy in favor of the possibility of hope. And precisely at this moment in Jerusalem's history, following the death of Herod, while there is and will be great turbulence in the political leadership of the city, nevertheless, as we will see tomorrow, among the descendants and students of the great sage Hillel will be found the hope for Judaism's future. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.